But what my rub today is when I see people and they hang their flags out on the porch, you know, to me, that's a rub in the face, because it's as though you're telling me you're not all American until you get you a flag and stand with us. Where we're going, we've constantly stood with you. We've stood with you when you didn't want us to stand with you.
Welcome to Faith in Each Other. I'll be your host, Jordan Howard. And on this show, I want to dive into the minds and the beliefs from people of all walks of life, baby boomers to millennials. No question is off limits as we learn together and go through the journey together of seeing where we, as a society, have gone wrong and where we have gotten it right. I believe that our faith in each other can lead us into a beautiful future. Each episode, I will be joined by Reverend David Williams, my pastor, and his good friend Tom Ingram, as we talk through challenges facing our society today and gain an understanding from different perspectives. Let's dive in.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the show, Faith in Each Other. Of course, I'm your host, Jordan, and I'm joined here today with Reverend David Williams and his good friend Tom Ingram. Hello, guys. How are you?
Morning. How are you?
Doing good. Good to see you, Jordan. Good to see you, Tom. Good.
Thanks, Jordan.
Good to see you guys. Yep. Hope you had a great week. Yeah, good. All right. So today's topic, war and division. Some major threats to our democracy are problems created by divisions within our nation, both intentional and unintentional. Primarily a division that exists from race, ethnicity, religion, and native language. If we are to regain faith in each other and faith in our democracy, we must learn to come together as one and not willingly fall victim to the powers that intend to divide us and in order to keep us down. And so I'm going to open up with today's topic with a question directed towards Tom. Please elaborate on your statement. Internal division is the risk and war is the medicine. Is the current war, a foreign war we have going on, is it healing or is it destructive? And is war ever healing?
So the when the Ukraine war first started, I went to Mill City and we prayed for the people of Ukraine, but we didn't pray for the people of Russia. And everybody was on the same side. Everybody was for Ukraine and against Russia. And I think it was just a fantastic feeling that you had in the room that we all agreed on something, that we're all on the same side. So I think this is a really good time to talk about this subject, because you can kind of feel the unity that, at least at, more at the beginning of the war, it's fading a little bit now. But you could really feel that sense of unity that we had a common purpose, that we were fighting this war for these people against these other people. So I think it's a really good time to talk about this because you can really feel it. But to me, if you look at the history of democracy, there are three main points that are salient to the subject. Democracies are always strong militarily, whether it's the Athenians, the Romans, Oliver Cromwell's England, Revolutionary France. Strong military is one of the benefits of democracy. And it makes sense because the average soldiers are motivated people. They have the right to vote, and that motivates them, and that helps in the war effort. But if you look at the history of democracy, democracies are strong militarily. Internal division is the risk. When any democracy that ever failed, I say that it's because of internal division. And you can cite any example, and I will tell you what the internal division is that caused that democracy to fail. But the problem is internal. It's not external. And then when we get attacked by someone else, when we're in a war like we are in Ukraine, that fixes the division problem. So if the democracy gets too divided to function, you can always just start a war and that'll pull everybody together. And when we see the bumper sticker that says, if you like your freedom, thank a veteran, or home of the free because of the brave, that bumper sticker is factually, historically incorrect. That is not the situation. The situation is that when democracies fail, it's because of an internal problem, not because of an external one. And so that commonly accepted principle of we defend our democracy through war is not just wrong, it's dangerous. Because when I see that bumper sticker, what I think, what I hear is maintaining democracy, the responsibility of that is for war age people. I'm not involved at all. I don't have to do anything because it's all about young people fighting in war. So to me, it's a way, it's the ultimate cop out that I don't have to contribute to democracy at all because it's all about the war thing. So to me, when you see that bumper sticker, it's a very commonly held thing in the United States that the way we defend our democracy is by sending our young people out there and defending it, that the risk to it is from external. And it's that is incorrect, and that's what we have to change.
Okay, thank you for that. Is war ever healing, Tom? I mean, is it, in your opinion, is it ever healing? Do you have any examples of the time that war fixed the actual problem that existed?
Yeah, I think that, where the United States was at war from 1942 to 1989, between World War II and the Cold War. And I believe that the Cold War was a great unifying force for our country, that we had this external enemy and that held us together. And then once the Berlin Wall fell, that's when our problems started. That's when we turned on each other, is when we didn't have the Cold War to unite us. And so if you look at the way people talk about President Biden right now, that would have been totally unacceptable in 1976 because he would have been helping the Soviets. They would have reprinted that in their newspaper. So the way we talk about each other right now, it would have been totally unacceptable then. So to my way of thinking, if you want to have an example of a war unifying, the Cold War is perfect. World War II is perfect. We're a very divided country when we entered World War II. And as soon as we were attacked at Pearl Harbor, everybody was on the same side.
Thank you for that. Pastor Dave, did you want to add anything to what Tom had mentioned there?
Only that when Tom says, it unified us or as a nation, it gave us a common cause of defending our country. But I think I take a slight step back, even though we all found that we had a common enemy. We also had internal turmoil at the same time. And so I just kind of deviate from exactly that we became a unified country because of war. I think men and women rose to wanted to make sure that they could explain or show that this they wanted to defend their country. For whatever reason, for the sanctity of the country, but that did not alleviate, that was not the only forces that were against that were happening in the country. And so even though war made us go and fight a common enemy, we still had many, many internal enemies other than war that were still going on. So I beg to differ only in that regard, but I understand what he's saying is that, when you're fighting a war against someone else, the family rallies together, but that may not be all the way clear as if all of our national issues, whatever our issues were, that they all dropped and we all ran to fight a common enemy. I think we even fought common enemies in the midst of being in a war. So I just want to throw that out there. I think it definitely says we have a common problem and we need to address and we come together to address that common problem, but that the war itself is not a healer for all of our problems. It just kind of recenters, where are we going to put our major efforts at that moment?
Yeah, healing is a bad word. Yeah, it's more like a painkiller. It doesn't really heal the problem, but it hides it underneath.
Yeah.
But I think that, but my opinion is during the Cold War, when we had that external enemy that would unite us, we forgot how to act in a democracy. Mm-hmm. That's what I believe, that the faith in each other is being the number one goal of a democracy. That's the ideology that we lost during the Cold War, because we had the Soviets to unite us, so we didn't have to do it ourselves. So to my way of thinking is during the Cold War, we lost the manners that we need to operate in a democracy. And I understand what Dave's saying, too, that the period I'm talking about is the high point of Jim Crow, too. So, you know, saying it worked or whatever. But what I'm saying about the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s is that the federal government was able to pass the budget. We were able to nominate a Supreme Court justice without getting in a slugfest. The mechanisms of the system operated. I'm not saying that we fixed all our problems, obviously, because, you know, that's a glaring example. But what I'm saying is the government was able to function in a way that it's not able to function now, where it's totally dysfunctional now. They can't pass a budget. They can't. The only way you can get a Supreme Court justice is if one party controls everything, so they can push the guy through now. Back in the day, I mean, back in 1976, Supreme Court justices would get 96 votes in the Senate. So, you know, it's not like everything was fixed, but the system right. worked. And it doesn't now. And we can't, the government is not able to address the country's problems now, whereas it was in 1976. And there's probably a lot of truth to that. The Cold War probably helped Jim Crow stay in business for a little bit longer than it did.
Yeah.
That's probably a lot of truth to that. So, you know, I hear what you're saying. It's not, yeah. it didn't fix it. It's a painkiller.
Yeah.
It's something that to just extends it. But the thing about the bumper stickers, what it shows is how wrong our vision of democracy is. So we're running the system. We don't even understand what the risk of it is. And that's why I'm so obsessed with those bank events. For your freedom, because we can't, democracy cannot be maintained at the point of a gun. It simply cannot. It has to be trust. It has to be faith. We have to believe in each other. If you look at the history of democracy, that's how they fail. They fail when people lose faith in each other. Once they lose faith in each other, then the elected government isn't legitimate and the system breaks down.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Tom. My next question is directed to Pastor Dave. Can you give us an example of a religious internal conflict that perhaps resulted in the division of that religion or even a war?
Well, I was thinking about that question, Jordan. We've always had religious division. And one of the major ones that I think about is during the Reformation, when the church itself just began to say, hey, the Protestants versus the Catholic Church just could not tolerate each other. And there was all sorts of breakouts throughout Europe trying to annihilate one. The strong Roman Catholic Church really wanted to subdue the Protestant movement, but it couldn't. Eventually, the Protestant movement got traction. And now, since 500 years ago, we have so many, many. I know when I was in college, there was over 1,000 different denominations in America. And this would have been in the mid-70s, the mid-70s. I don't know how many we have now past that. And those are by religious differences. It's just because interpretation, very seldom do we have religious breakdown over doctrine. It's normally some type of mechanical division, whether it is legal or hierarchy. It isn't, there was no division of, do we not believe in God? That wasn't the issue. It was who was going to run the church, who got to write the textbooks of the church, who got to explain the legal rights of the church. So it wasn't doctrinal. It was more of positional, who gets to be in power. So we've always had division. I mean, you have Baptists, you have Methodists, you have Pentecostal, you have Lutheran, you have Episcopalian. I mean, the gambit just goes, and it's because everyone will come to a point where they says, my way is the more primary way. This is what we should be emphasizing. And when you cannot stay in unity with that, you normally go off and create another entity that your group can come around. So that's probably been on, that's probably been a part of us. And even when you get into the scriptures, you have, you know, the different layers of the Hebrews, you know, your Sadducees versus the Essenes, you know, it's constantly men and women often will come to odds with each other in how to promote or present its faith, you know, as one group determines that it's true. So we've always been in that, in that mode, Jordan. We've always been there. That's not new. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Tom. Is there anything you wanted to add on there? Any insight you have perhaps on that?
Question. I got a question for both of you. My opinion, speaking as a white man, and, you know, maybe totally off base, obviously, but kind of the way I see European-American and African-American relationship is that our relationship works best when there is war, when we're at war, we need each other a little bit more. And I view our relationship as being like one war on top of another. Each time we go to war and the African Americans fight with us when we really need them, it like improves the relationship between us. So I was just curious if you guys had any opinion about that. And then, you know, it's Morgan Freeman's birthday today. And my question for you is, why did he sign up for the Air Force?
I'll take a stab. Let me speak to, I'll start with Morgan Freeman. Why did Morgan Freeman, you know, 60 years ago or 70 years ago, 60 years ago, sign up for military? Well, in the Black culture, especially during the Civil War, slaves quickly found that if they chose a side to help defend, it was an open door to move away from slavery. It was an opportunity to get out from up under, quote, the whip. And so you wanted to show your patriotism, your devotion by saying, I want to help you defend our enemy, because they were given so little credit as being human beings. And so it went during World War II, which my father fought in, which was a racially segregated military for America. The Tuskegee Airmen and all of those military men had to prove over and over, we are legitimately participants in the preservation of America. And it was always a proving factory. It was, we must prove our devotion to you. And how we prove our devotion, we lay our lives on the line, just like every other white man. We wanted to put our lives on the line for the protection of America. And so many times we have joined the wars, not so much as we want to, you know, we want to protect America flat out. It also has been a way of promoting we are American. And I say this and that because, Tom, you say I'm a white man, you know, I say, you know, okay, I'm a Black guy. But what my rub today is when I see people and they hang their flags out on the porch, you know, to me, that's a rub in the face, because it's as though you're telling me you're not all American until you get you a flag and stand with us. Where we're going, we've constantly stood with you. We've stood with you when you didn't want us to stand with you. We've been lynched when, you know, we came home from America. I mean, from Germany. You know, we came home. We couldn't get a house. We couldn't buy a car. My daddy couldn't buy a car.
Oh, I know, but then why are you patriotic?
because we're saying if this will help to show you that we are 100% vested in this country, we will vest ourselves in the country, but it just often hasn't worked.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then. Okay, yeah. So if you have a group and then mm-hmm. you have an abused minority mm-hmm. that's discriminated against and Jim Crow and all that, would you expect them to fight in the next war with you? Because I would not. I would not expect them to be patriotic. This is not a natural reaction that I would expect.
But Tom, that's just it. We have wanted people to say, we have wanted people to give us the thumbs up. You are an American. But that affirmation has been constantly withheld. It's been constantly moved that your proving that you are American is not good enough. You fought in every war that has happened to America, from civil wars to revolutionary war. We have participated in every war. But yet I see people are saying, if you don't like America, you ain't got no flag up. You don't have no flag. You must not be really American. You know, why don't y'all stand? And we're going, that's what we've been trying to do. But whatever has been given to solidify our nationality seem like it's constantly moving. But we as a people who were brought to this country are keep saying, well, what do you want me to do next? Because we actually don't live in another country. We're born here. We are birthed here. So we don't have double citizenship. So this is our country. So it has been over and over. It's not that we want to go to, I mean, if I just saw yesterday, they were talking about when will World War III happen. I don't know if y'all saw that rendition, but that came out yesterday. Well, you know, still World War III kick off. We're going to join. We're going to suit up. We're going to get ready to go, because we're saying this is our country too. We're just waiting on other people to say, stop telling me when I fly a flag, or if I kneel when the national anthem is playing, when I do those things, then you must be really one of us. We've always tried to be one of you, but you have not readily accepted us. And we've even laid our life down on the line for it. We just don't know what it's going to take to finally get the affirmation, but we're willing to do it because this is our country.
Yeah, you've laid your life on the line for your oppressors.
Yeah, for our oppressor. Yes, Tom. We have laid our lives, and that's exactly it, for the oppressor, but the oppressor yet won't go, you're one of us.
Okay, leaving that for a second. But I'm talking about, I'm talking about the power of unification, of having an external enemy, and I think this is a really good example of it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think part of what it was is you look at white America and you go, well, I don't really like what I see. And then you look over at Hitler and it's like, ooh.
Yeah. Do you want that?
Yeah, that doesn't sound any better. So,
you know, Tom, when you speak about the unity, we all remember the movie Forrest Gump.
Right.
You know, when Forrest Gump goes to Vietnam and him and Bubba becomes these great friends. You know, I think that was in essence true. Blacks became, we're in the same foxhole fighting the same Viet Cong. And it also let us drop our guards down for a moment. We drop guards down and say, hey, Bubba, you're from Louisiana. Forrest, you're from wherever. You know, we could be friends. And for a brief moment in our history, those wars have allowed us to relax somewhat. But the problem is when the war, you're right, when the war goes away, it's almost like we revert, or we transform to something worse, or we just go, that was fun while we were fighting a common enemy, but right now we are each other's enemy. And that seems to be the recurring tale. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. My fear right now is that the unity we have in this war in Ukraine feels so good. It feels so good. We're all on the same side. Oh, dude, I want some more. And then we end up in World War III at the end. What we should be doing is telling the Ukrainians to stand down. Mm-hmm. Because there's going to be starvation in Africa. Africa's going to take the biggest hit on this thing because they import a lot of their grain. Right. And that includes Egypt, of course. But there's going to be a famine because of this war. Yes. My fear is that we're doing it because it makes us feel unified.
Yes.
And the actual war itself is destructive. I don't know if you remember in 2000 when we did the war in Iraq, the theme, the saying that went with the war was "United we stand." And people would tell you that. It feels so good to be united. Yeah, until the nuclear bomb comes over and lands on your house. And then it's not quite so good. But again, I think that the war has really improved the relationship between the African-American community and the European-American community. I think a lot of the, you know, like you were saying about Forrest Gump, but I think a lot of it, every time we get a war, is our communities come closer together, you know, and that's still kind of the way I see it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that, guys. Lots of good stuff there. And you kind of touched on my next question there, Tom. How successful is our democracy in handling that deep divide, you know, like example, blacks and whites, the rich and poor? How do we determine the degree of success when dealing with those divisions?
So the way I like to measure success is by the marriage question. You know, the marriage question, we have a lot of data about the marriage question. And it started with the racial thing, right? How would you feel if you're, and it's not whether you would get married. It's how would you feel if your kid married an African American or something like that?
Right.
And just recently, I know you guys are going to be excited about this. We crossed over to the point where people are more uncomfortable with their kids marrying outside the party than outside the race.
Right.
We actually achieved that.
Yeah.
But anyway, my way to measure the amount of unity we have in the country is to ask the question how you would feel about your child marrying somebody from the other party. Mm-hmm. And that to me is the number one indicator. Right now it's bad. And in 1960, you know, we were talking about Jim Crow and how it was good back then. In 1960, like 5% of the people total would feel uncomfortable with their kid marrying outside the party. Now it's 70%. Mm-hmm. It's two-thirds of the people. And like I said, they'd be much more comfortable with their kid marrying an African-American Republican than a white Democrat. So, you know, I don't know if that's progress, but that's the way I would measure success.
Okay. Pastor Dave, did you have an example or a way to determine how we measure that success?
I think Tom's analogies are right on. And I hear and read those same data that, you know, people are more concerned. Some people are greatly concerned with if you marry outside the party, or if you will, you know, what party you belong to versus at times what race you belong to, which is a definitely swing. But I will say this on behalf of people of color, you know, people of color, you know, we take so many things different, as of their order of importance than many of our counter, you know, white Americans, you know, and that's still, we've got to be aware of that plays a part. When my older brother was in Vietnam in the 60s, many, many African American brothers came home with Viet Cong wives. They came home married to Vietnamese women, you know. But what happened, even when that happened, the African American family just put their arms around that Vietnamese person. We didn't miss a beat. It was like, hey, welcome to the family. You like cornbread? Do you like greens? You like chicken? And it was welcome to the family. So we did not have to adjust to another ethnic group. It was that in our way of life, it is, you are welcome. we move later into these last 10, 20 years, and now especially these last 20 years, when we have talked about, our sexuality. Again, the approach to sexuality is somewhat different in the African-American and the white American culture. Yeah, I was talking to a group of pastors a couple of years ago, and one pastor said his family was very clear. If my child happens to be gay or lesbian, they are quickly ostracized from the family, cut off, no inheritance. You know, you're out. I'm going into African-American family, and all right, let's move on. You know, Dave is now Davina, and we just move on. And so when it comes to politics, because we have no dying affiliation to a Democrat or a Republican, that is not a primary for us. That's not a deal breaker for us. And so we are still seeking equality for all people, justice for all people, Republican, Democrat, independent, gay, straight, disabled, old, young. We are still in that place of fighting for a freedom that is yet to be realized, when there are those who don't know that place of we can pick and choose what freedoms need to be really embraced. And so that's somewhat of a difference in how we see, you know, will you marry a Republican or will you marry a Democrat? It does affect us. Now, we'll not cut that off. We do have discussions about that, because even today, the majority of African Americans, and I would say, I don't even know if it's majority anymore, but growing up, most African Americans voted Democratic. And so when we hear of Blacks who are Republican, we still get that. What? Whoa. What are you doing over there? Do you know who they are? And so
yeah. What did they do to bribe you?
Right? Yeah. What did they? Yes, exactly.
He's
what,
more
did they,
dangerous
what did they give you?
Over there.
You know, are they letting you move into the country club or stuff like that? So that is real, but it's not a deal breaker for us. We are still focused on the equality component, the justice component, reality in America. And we know that is interwoven through all of these subcultures. So, yeah.
And you're not going to get it without faith in each other, though.
Yes, that's exactly
equality.
You
know, without,
you cannot get it alone. So we, the oppressed are the oppressed, and the oppressed are not just Black. They're not just white. The oppressed people can't get jobs right now. We don't just advocate people getting jobs because of your Black. We're advocating all of this for every person, because we believe when everybody is served, everybody benefits. So, yeah.
Thank you for that. My next question is we've kind of talked about it briefly. Pastor Dave, is there a difference between a religious democracy and a religious dictatorship? Does either have a better countermeasure to prevent that internal war and division?
What I think you're asking me is there such a thing as a theocracy? Can we live under the banner of a theocracy? And personally, I say that's a dangerous place to live, because we are not all of the same faith. That's just who we are. Or no faith. You know, we live in a country that is very diverse in their religious practices. And for a theocracy to be in place, that would mean a theocracy will open the door for a religious ruler or dictator to use that as his or her religion, his or her faith is the reason you can live in this country, which I think would open the door to a greater problem. I do want to throw this in, though, Jordan, when I look at your question for today. Nowhere in scripture does God embrace a war for the sake of promoting the gospel. Hebrews are never, ever in war trying to advance their gospel. That's throughout the scriptures. But there are wars that God can use the war to discipline his disobedient children. But it wasn't that he used the war to benefit or to, the war was not his idea of, I will sanction a war. That's not biblical. Nowhere throughout the scriptures are wars ever instituted or embraced by God as the right direction to, for man to travel. War, again, is a construct of human beings. When I do not get my way, I go to war with you. I will fight you. I will try my best to hurt you until you either cry uncle or give me what I want. And that's war is not even in our Christian scriptures. War is never celebrated by God. So war doesn't bring us to a more humane position. If anything, war moves us to a more inhumane position, because that's power. Those who have the most power will control the weakest. And so the Bible does never says, let's use war. God uses war as a way to advance the gospel, which, and I will say this, that many of my peers in Christianity will want to say, God wants us to be in war and we have to war so the gospel can go forward. That's not biblical. That is unbiblical. There is no line in the Bible that we are to go out and kill someone. And I say this, Debbie gave me a statement this week, which really scared me. There's a pastor in America, somewhere in America this week, went down on record by saying, he said something to the effect that those who are disobedient to Christianity, and especially he was alluding to those who walk in a sexual, in a anti-sexual way that is embraced by the majority of Christians. He says, we should take a gun to the back of their heads. And this was in a sermon. This was on a Sunday morning. What he was saying is, I embrace murdering you when you don't believe what I believe. For me, he also gave a thumbs up for somebody to walk out of his church and go into a school, go right. into a grocery store, go into a, mm-hmm. he just says, in the name of God, you have the right to do it. I'm going, that's not the God I serve, nor would it ever be the God I would serve. No way, no how.
Absolutely not. Tom, did you have anything you wanted to add on to that?
Well, just that, I saw a sermon at one of our local churches. That was the last time I ever went there. It was pro-war in 03. But I think the religious community was very associated with that war in the original Gulf War. And, I love the speech that President Bush gave, where he got up there and he said, we're going to invade Iraq. We're going to turn them into a democracy. And there's going to be all kinds of advantages for us, including democracies don't invade other countries. So, once we make Iraq a democracy, they won't attack their other countries. It's like, right. You're a democracy, you're invading Iraq.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry, dude. But anyway, back to the matter is, okay, two things for me. One, war is bad. Kills people, destroys stuff, it causes bad feelings. Two, democracies go to war more than the other countries do. And that's just a reality to it, because it fixes our internal, it pulls us together, and we can feel that happening now. Those are the two things I would say.
Okay. Well, thank you for that.
Jordan, I think that's huge to hear, that war has a benefit, but democracies will go into wars more often. I think that's deep to be heard. I think that's really needed to be heard. We think of democracy not making us at odds with each other, because we always say, oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Let's go for that. But democracy opens up the door and say, I don't like this. Oh, but I like this. Well, until you like what I like. So democracy in the fantasy world looks like it would be more soothing and agreeable to us, where in reality it's brutal and it's painstaking to achieve the goals for everyone versus to achieve the goals just for one. And that to me is what we don't hear in democracy, especially today. Everybody saying, I'm going to do it my way. I was watching the proceedings this week and just stuff I already knew, but you got somebody saying, I'm going to take this country over and do it my way. And I'm going to kick everybody else out. Yeah. Whoa, what are you thinking? So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. As we draw near to the end of our episode, how do we fight forces that want us divided? When we are divided, we're too distracted to unite for the betterment of all. How do we rebuild faith in each other? And I know we've talked about it before, that outreach. So I'm gonna leave with this, leave you both with this question. How are you going to practice faith in each other this week? I mean, I know it's a very big question kind of to ask, but final thoughts for the episode.
I'll go first because I was waiting on this question. I was practicing all week for this question when I got it. No, I had read in the scriptures this week. I was just doing some morning meditations, and there's this verse in 2 John says, "I have told you my greatest command is that you would love one another. If one loves one another, then God is within him," basically within him or her, because God is causing you to reach out to one another. And I just kind of thought about our conversation coming up, and I said, what will I do? It is, I still want to act. I want to act out my faith without having to be verbally always talking about it. And the way I can do that is to show respect and honor to those around me. And I'm trying to do that day to day, not when I go to the pulpit to write a sermon or preach a sermon, but I want to be a neighbor to I want to be a light to my neighbors. My neighbors are moving. They gave the greatest compliment that I could ever get. I mean, I was stoked. They said that I saw them put a sign to move in their front yard. And I said, I saw him drive up and he goes, yeah, Dave, we're moving. And I said, well, man, I'm sorry. We were throwing so many parties and we had so many people in the yard. He goes, Dave, no way. No way. He goes, and his wife came out. He goes, we really don't want to move unless you guys can move with us. You are the best neighbors we've ever had. That to me is what I want to be. The best neighbor, the best friend, and I don't wear a sign. If I can cut your grass, I'm gonna cut it. If I can help you get to the grocery store, I'm going to do it. That to me is how I'll do it. This is my man one-to-one. It is, let me show the love that I talk about and preach about versus let me preach about it and think it's making a difference. I just prefer to show it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that, Pastor Dave. Tom, did you have any feedback to that question?
Yeah, what I'm going to do this week to help alleviate the divisions that we have in our country is start every comment that I have by acknowledging the legitimacy of the other person's position.
Yeah.
So instead of, you know, I probably didn't do that on this podcast. It's a goal, right? But anyway, to me, that would be the best way. That's a really great way to try to unify people, is when somebody says something you disagree with it, to say, I disagree with it, but I acknowledge that your position is legitimate. I don't agree with it, but I don't think that what you're saying is stupid or,
you know, right,
or evil or anything like that. It's, I disagree with it because I have a different opinion. It's not a certainty. But I think that one of the things we could really do in our country, if we wanted to, is just start with, I think your position is legitimate. And I acknowledge that you're, that it's okay for you to think that.
Yeah.
And then it's just a pro forma thing to get the person so that you're both humans on the same level, right? And then they can hear. Then you can, speak.
Well, thank you for that, Tom. Of course, I'm going to chime in. I, you know, plan to have that walk of integrity, you know, and treat every person with grace. Like you said, Tom, you know, come into the situation and say, hey, your point of view is, you know, correct. Or, you know, whatever the case, I'm not going to make them feel like I'm attacking them. Treating everybody with that grace. And like, you know, Pastor Dave said, I try to help my neighbors all the time, you know, and some don't like me, but I'm, you know, working on it. So I want to be loved like Pastor Dave, you know, I want my neighbors to love me and I want to love my neighbors just the same. So yeah, that's my answer for that.
But if they don't love you, that's their problem.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right.
I'm just saying, you know,
I'm a pretty lovable
it's
guy.
It's not really on you. Yeah. Part of the whole
Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for joining me again today. And of course, thank you all for joining us here on the show, Faith in Each Other. And we will see you next week.
Thanks, Jordan. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Jordan. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much for listening to Faith in Each Other. I hope today's conversation encourages you in your journey to have hard conversations and, most importantly, to listen to others around you. If we're going to have faith in each other, I believe we need to be willing to have hard conversations, and that is what we aim to do on this show. We will see you next time on Faith in Each Other. If you enjoyed this show, please share it with someone you know. See you next time.